seen as far as it decomposition, the 3 plus 1 decomposition of the equations. And our goal is to start with a covariant theory. So we have, say, GAB equal A pi TAB. And ultimately, what we're interested in is in being able to iterate those equations and find a solution to the problem. And you know the solution to this problem will be, well, given a manifold, a Lorentzian metric that will solve these equations given some prescribed sources. But we have the solution is a solution over a whole manifold. So how are we going to make or try to make sense of something that we give the condition at some given instance of time, and we want to find out what its future evolution is? So for that, we're going to have to essentially do what Einstein worked so hard to do, which was to break this equation that is in covariant form. We're going to try to break it in such a way that now we can make sense of something at some given instance of time, and then try to obtain the evolution to the future of it. So I'm just going to give you two references, where this is discussed in traditional books. One would be Meissner, Turner, Wheeler, and what we're going to be discussing essentially is chapter 21. And this is a description that has what we're going to discuss. I'll start with things that are drawn from here. But this is kind of the least elegant way, is the most kind of direct way. So it helps us to fix ideas. But for a more kind of formal discussion, I would suggest works by Jimmy York in a book called Sources for Sources of Gravitational Radiation, or World, and this is chapter, it's chapter 10 and appendix 2 of his book. So the key point that we're after is try to introduce some way of splitting our, say, manifold that I'm going to represent this way with some notion of some initial time at which we know what the state of our system is. We know our metric, or somehow we know the information of the space-time here, and we want to know what happens to the future of it. But of course, we know we have to face several problems. We don't have, there is no unique time. There is no unique notion of time. There is no unique way to assign labels to points which are events in our manifold. And so somehow we want to do it without losing everything, without throwing the baby with the bathwater, as far as trying to have things that are as covariant as possible, given what we're setting up to do. So let me just introduce. So we have a set of notes that are in the web page. Everything I'm going to be saying here are in those notes. The very first part is all in handwritten notes. That's what I'm going to try to go more in more detail. Which side is the one? One doesn't clean and the other one messes things up. The rest are all LaTeX notes that are very clean. So I'll go slowly through the first ones and then just pick different pieces that are more relevant of the LaTeX ones, and I'm going to ask you to go through them as well. Okay, so the perspective we're going to take is something that was dubbed geometrodynamics by Wheeler, where what we're going to be trying to do is just split our manifold into something that has some meaning, some geometrical meaning, and that will be the geometry of some given hypersurfaces. And then we're going to imagine that the spacetime will be a collection of these hypersurfaces, and our task will be to understand how these hypersurfaces and the metric, therefore, inducing them changes as we go forward to the future. So a little bit of notation. We're going to assume, and then this we'll discuss more later, that we have arbitrary labels for our space-time events. But for that, what we want to do is now split in coordinates, where we're going to imagine that we have some notion of time, that again, it's completely free. We're going to have to try to keep that freedom with us as much as we can, and labels for space points that are correspondent to fixed, at any given fixed time, we have labels for this, the points on these manifolds. So a little bit of notation. Typically, we'll use either Greek indices or early part in the alphabet. Letters to denote space-time indices. So if I use mu, alpha, a, b, c, we're thinking these guys range from 0 to 3. And I'm going to imagine that 0, we're sticking the time in the 0 coordinate, in the 0 label. And even if we use middle to n Latin indices, these are just spatial indices. So if I go I, j, k, that would be just 1 to 3. Of course, and everything we'll discuss will be generic. We're going to be able to discuss this or extend these to higher dimensions if we so wish to. Let's see, not this one. Actually, I did it the wrong way. So let me start here, and then we're going to go. Well, this, we're not saying anything important here. So this will, while we're going to keep our interest for the time being in four dimensions, this can be immediately extended to higher dimensions. We can go as long as we put one dimension in time, everything else would be the lower dimension analysis space. Okay, so we're going to assume that our manifold can be split by a series of hypersurfaces, which we're going to label by sigma of t. We're still going to then discuss more about how we choose the time. And we're going to demand that these are space-like. That is, if we have at a given hypersurface, so let me just take one of them and represent it here, and we have two points, P and P prime. That is now a manifold that is three-dimensional. And it's, we're going to consider each one of these have their own intrinsic properties as just differential manifolds. So if we imagine that we have a metric here, we can also imagine we have an R metric in here, which allows us to measure distances. And this we're going to call, say, gamma ij. And what we're demanding is that the distance between P and P prime, let me just call it ds square in the three-dimensional space-time between P and P prime is greater than 0. We're taking a signature where we have minus our signature would be minus plus plus plus. But also, given this hypersurface, which again we're seeing as its own true differential manifold, is embedded, as we said, in this four-dimensional manifold, we can always define here normal vectors at any given point. It's a normal to this hypersurface. We're going to give it a special name. We're going to call it NA. And this assumption implies that GAB, say NA and D is equal to minus one, right? If the space like this hypersurface is space-like, its normal has to be time-like. We have chosen a signature that has minus plus plus, so this has to be satisfied by the normal vector to the hypersurface. Notice I already are making a difference here when I'm calling the metric. The metric to the three hypersurface gamma, well, the four-dimensional metric to SG. So now we're going to picture, say, two different hypersurfaces. We have defined our normal vector, say, normal to that point. And we can always ask the question as to what is a proper distance or proper time going from here, this point, to that point. So here is where we're going to encounter our first kind of quirkiness that we have to take into account. Let's imagine that this is a hypersurface that was sitting at this label that we introduced to label each subsequent hypersurface to be t. Let's imagine this one to be t plus delta t. Now, the space M can be curved. We never have said anything about how curved our manifold may be. So actually, the proper time between here and there could be significantly different than just the t. Right? If we were in flat space-time, the proper time from here to there would be dt, but not necessarily here because we're considering a general manifold. So there could be curvature that changes that. So we're going to say that the relationship between the proper time and the label, the difference in the labels, is given by a function which we're going to call alpha. And this proper time will be alpha times dt, and this alpha is referred to as the Laplace function. We'll see later on how it comes in a much more geometrical way of understanding this problem. Okay, so let's assume that that point, the point that we took to get the normal from it, was given labels xi. There is nothing that tells us that we should choose that point to have exactly the labels. We have complete freedom to do that. So let me just assume that actually there was this other point here that has the same label. Now let's try to write what is the distance between two points, say P and Q, one in the first hypersurface, one in the second. So let me imagine that this point is a point P, and then we have a point Q here. I want to compute that distance. And of course, we're imagining that this point is sufficiently close to that one such that we can make a sense of all this in differential terms. So dt is not too large, and the distance between that point and this point is not too large, so that if for all intents and purposes, I can imagine this is joined by straight lines. So we want to measure the distance between this point and that point. And we have to take into account that now our labels, so this point, say, is sitting as xi plus delta xi, we have to take into account that we also introduce kind of a shift in coordinates. So when we measure the distance between here and there, we have to take into account that xi plus dxi is not really the distance from here to there. It's only the distance from that point to that point, right? So we need to add this piece. And so this piece is also given, is defined by the following. Beta I, we're introducing a shift vector, or it's called the shift vector, to denote the fact that we have a freedom, or we have an ambiguity in how we label points into different hypersurfaces. So this is the shift. So now we can compute what the distance between the two points are. And again, as I said, we're imagining that these dt's are sufficiently short, small, that we can imagine that this is a straight line from here to there and a straight line from here to there. So the distance between the two points will be given by minus alpha squared dt squared. That's this piece. And because we have a Lorentzian signature, this has a minus sign. Plus, now this distance, we imagine that the metric in this new hypersurface is given by this gamma ij that I defined, times the distance on the new hypersurface, which is not dx, it's dx plus beta I dt. And so now we can, if you want, we can put everything together that has dt, that has cross terms, and that only has spatial points. So we have this. So this is how we're writing our metric, or this one way to write our metric, which allows us now to identify our full matrix GAB in terms of our these new things that we have introduced, where sitting in the TT component is this guy. Sitting in the purely spatial part of the metric is the gamma ij. And in the cross terms, we just have gamma ij beta I. Right? So we have managed now to rewrite our metric in terms of something that is a metric purely related to the space-like hypersurface, and now these other things that we have introduced, and we can do the counting. So we have the last function, that's one piece of information. The shift vector, that's three pieces of information together. They give us four pieces that we can give, and what we'll see later, or what we'll discuss later on, is that this we can freely specify it if you want, and then they encode the freedom that we have to choose four coordinates that we knew we had. So one particular thing we note here is that the purely spatial part of our metric, now understood with respect to these coordinates that we introduced, is nothing but gamma ij. And also we can check that the determinant of the full metric G, square root, and with a minus sign, which will show up all over the place, is going to be equal to this function alpha times the determinant of gamma. That will come in handy once we start trying to rewrite some particular differential equations, and not write it in terms of the full metric, but write it in terms of the free metric. So what we're going to do is, as I kind of anticipated before, so rather than using or thinking of Einstein's equations as being equations for a full spacetime, it's going to be a way to rewrite how these differential hypersurfaces embedded in the full dimensional, in the full four-dimensional spacetimes, behave as we go forward to the future. And that will give us a recipe to provide the state of the system at some given time and go forward. Okay, so we need to introduce a few more concepts. So one of them will be to know the following. said we had this normal vector, normal to the hypersurface, the spatially hypersurfaces. We can think of lowering the indices with the Phoon metric. And this actually will turn out to be something here. Let me just call it for the moment N0, and then we'll discuss what else it would be. And the reason we can do that is because we're saying that this hypersurface is sitting at some t equal constant. We know that if, so this is a hypersurface, this is some given t. If this hypersurface is defined by t being equal a constant, we know that the normal, the dual, or the dual vector normal to t is defined by, sorry, not normal to the hypersurface, is simplified, defined by grad of t. So the vector, when these indices downstairs, will only have a non-trivial value sitting at the time component. But we also want it, of course, we want to kind of not have a completely arbitrary n. We want n to have unit normal, as we discussed before. So then we want this to be satisfied. So if we use this one, we have g 0, 0, n0, and 0 to be minus 1. And we can compute, given our expression for the metric. So we just wrote that gab can be written in terms of our functions like this. And this, of course, I'm slightly abusing notation here because it's a number. This is a vector, so we have to imagine it as a column. This we have to imagine that vector as a row, and this is a 3x3 matrix. You can check very easily that the inverse of this guy is given by that. And here I'm going to use this to stress two facts. Notice that before, when we took the full metric and we just looked for the purely spatial part of the metric, gij, it was precisely equal to the gamma ij. But if we try to do this here, or we ask the same question here, notice that gij is no longer gamma ij. There is another piece. And this is going to be generically true when we have a tensor that is defined in the full dimensional spacetime that is of type any tensor of type, say, 0L. That is, there it has no contravariant components, it's purely covariant, has purely covariant components. Its purely spatial part will correspond to the purely spatial part of induced tensor on that hypersurface. And we'll discuss later how the induction it is to be thought. But the very simple rationale behind why this is the case, so let's imagine we have a vector, a tensor of type 0L, or for the simplicity of discussion, let's see, there's a two-tensor defined that way. If we want to understand what is Tij, we would just hit this vector with this tensor with two vectors, or two basis vectors that are purely spatial. And when we do that, we just get defined a Tij. And because we have defined, or we're splitting our space time as a series of this hypersurface, and this E sub ijs live precisely on the hypersurface, the only thing this operation does is just pick the ij components. And that wouldn't be the analog for the contravariant ones. And this is why we pick this extra piece here and we don't have the analog in the covariant representation. But the other thing I wanted to mention about this is, so we now know that G00 is minus 1 over alpha squared. If we put this in here, and we try to force this to be the case, we find out that Na then has to be equal to minus alpha 0, 0, 0. So that's the co-vector or associated to that vector. Are we okay so far? Yes.
Why the minus?
So the minus, this minus is because you can see it in two, or you can argue it in two ways. We know that we have, let's for simplicity, we can always take, you know, they can always take a point on an arbitrary small region in your spacetime where the metric can be approximated arbitrarily well as a flat metric, unless you're sitting at a singularity. But let's say we're not in that case. So in that case, a metric GAB will be, as we said, arbitrarily well approximated by just the minus 1, 1, 1, right? The Minkowski metric. So we know that we raise indices with the metric. So when I hit this, we use this metric to raise this, I'm going to have a plus. And that gives us a vector that is pointing in the positive direction. Of course, there is nothing that stops us from using the positive sign here, but now we're going to have to interpret that going up in t in time will be going negative with respect to this label that we have introduced. So it's a convention. But where you choose in a particular convention so as to make sure that at least the vector makes sense as far as something that flows up. So we're almost done as with respect to introducing the basic pieces we need to recode all the information that we would have from the four-dimensional point of view as things in the three-dimensional. And we have to now introduce perhaps the most important concept. Which is the following. So we have said we took our spacetime and we slice it or interpret it as a sequence of hypersurfaces. So let me ask you a question. So what is if space, the intrinsic metric or the metric that you would have on a piece of paper if it's not bent or anything? So what's the metric? How do I take distances between two arbitrary points on the sphere, on the space of piece of paper?
The Euclidean metric.
And in this case, it would be the flat metric, right? So it would be just Euclidean 1, 1, 1. But if I imagine that this piece of sheet is embedded in this three-dimensional space-time, the metric, the intrinsic metric, will always be the flat, no matter what I do. But where I have it like this or like that, we need another concept to tell where it's curved or not. And in fact, we may end up choosing something that has, at least for some moment of time, a metric that is an intrinsic metric that is completely flat, but there is curvature in the spacetime. So we need another concept that will have that information built in. And that is this thing called extrinsic curvature. Or sometimes referred to as the second fundamental form. And that's nothing more than what we just said. Given a hypersurface, we want to be able to distinguish this from that. So we have so far only defined the intrinsic metric to the hypersurface, and the only thing that knows where this would be like this or like that is the unit vector that we have defined. Because if we have this vector behaving like that, and we ask how does this vector varies as we move around, or how it varies in this case, of course, we will notice the difference. And the definition of the extrinsic curvature in the most straightforward way will be being something which we're going to denote by k with indices ij, because we're trying to say this is going to be a purely spatial tensor given by minus grad I and J. Again, this minus sign is a convention. It doesn't matter because where we have the plus or the minus, our goal was to be able to tell somehow where our slice was curved or not with respect to the higher space-time. But this is the standard or one standard way of doing it. And the one thing that we'll be able to prove is that this tensor also has an addition property, which is that it is symmetric. These are things that we'll discuss as we go along in this presentation. But let me just say at least one other thing that is this is going to be able to tell us is, let's see what the result of this is. So let me just try to compute kind of brute force way what it's going to be, that quantity, the grad I or the grad of nj purely on the special direction. So this by definition is the I of nj minus mu ij and mu. And here is, we're seeing there's now a mix of these labels. I and j are the node where it's talking about spatial indices, but this mu ranges over all of them. But we just discussed that n mu only has a zero component. It doesn't have a component in the spatial direction. So this is like that. Nj is identically zero because, well, by definition, this one is not there. So it's just minus gamma 0 ij and 0. And this is given by minus alpha. And so now we can just write what the Christoffel symbol would be. And the Christoffel symbol would be 1/2 of, let's say, g for simplicity, I'm going to bring everything downstairs. When we expand gamma 0 ij, we're going to have terms that goes like this. And that's the only one I care to discuss at the moment, is that we see this term. Remember, gamma gij was the same thing as gamma ij. And so what it's telling us is that this k ij that we defined has a term that goes like, okay, we have the 1/2, sorry, this 1/2 shouldn't be here. We have the 1/2 multiplying the minus gamma ij, and we have an alpha as a common factor. So it goes like minus 1 over 2, and then we have gamma ij, comma t, and up to factors. And so what we are doing is we're being able to reinterpret this gamma, this kij, which is extrinsic curvature, as a rate of change of our intrinsic curvature versus time. So it tells us, in a sense, the velocity of these gamma ij's. So that will give us, once we are done, the first of Einstein's equations we're going to use to evolve the system. The other one that we're after is to find out what this gamma ij is. And we're going to see that there is an evolution equation that tells us the time derivative of this gamma kij is related to a bunch of things that know about the curvature and any possible source that we have in the system.
Okay, question. So here the extrinsic curvature is only this term, because it's the only term, because all these alpha and beta only depend on time, right?
No, alpha and beta can depend on time and space. So we're going to go slowly over the whole derivation. But this, I mean, alpha and beta are completely free.
Okay.
So in some sense, this is what you do. You first have your manifold, and you sprinkle that manifold with labels, t and x, which are completely arbitrary. Now, with that, you want to define these hypersurfaces. So I have my manifold, and I define these labels. And then I choose the hypersurfaces to connect all these T's. That I say I put the T here and a point with the same T there, so I connect them. If I didn't do it correctly, then it might be that the hypersurface that I end up defining in that space, like, then I have to fix it. But let's say you do it such that it's satisfied. But once I do that, I can always define that my lapse here, right, is going almost to zero. So in fact, there is almost, there is no time progressing in this direction when there is a lot in there. So then after the fact, we're going to be able to reinterpret in physical terms that this manifold, even though, say, these two points have different, almost very different time levels, the amount of real time that has progressed there is almost none. And so now if you think of the hypersurfaces in physical terms, maybe what you're doing is this. Right? And depending on the application, that may be a useful thing to do, or maybe something that you actually try to avoid as much as you can. So now we need to try to obtain this law that will tell us how K is going to evolve, but we're going to try to do it in the most general way possible. And one simple way would be go to Einstein's equations, the RAB, use this definition of K, stick it in there, and through brute force, then go and replace back till you get something that will tell us what the Kij is. But actually, there are much better ways of doing this. And so let us discuss those. So that one doesn't work. Yes? No, it's the front one. Okay. So let me just kind of formalize a little bit what we just discussed and then move from there. So one thing is we're going to consider, as I said, that this time, this hypersurface that has time t, the normal to it being grad A of t, and we want it to be uninormal, so we know we have to multiply this by minus alpha. This is what we just discussed, having defined it in the way we mentioned. So that's the first thing we want to stress. The second one is we want to also recall that there could be an acceleration, that vector can be changing in an accelerated way, and the definition of the acceleration is simply right. So that's the rate of change of the vector n as we flow along n. The next thing we want to do is to be able to systematically define projections of our vectors and tensors. So we're going to define a projector. To be, and we're going to denote it like this. So this is our definition. And we can raise and lower indices as we want. Notice that this, we'll discuss why it is a projector, but the first thing, let me just discuss, this is a full four-dimensional tensor. So we're creating a tensor with this funny symbol. Here is a full four-dimensional concept, so is this one. But this one allows us to do the following. Suppose I want to do this operation. So I take the vector, the n vector, the normal vector, and I heat it. I look at what the contraction is with this projector. So I'm going to have term by term the following. This is just nothing because the metric with the index, one index up and one index down, is just a delta, so this just gives us NA. This other one gives us NA here, but here is a contraction of N with itself, which is equal to minus 1. And this is how we have defined things. Have we chosen the different convention for end, we could have put a minus there, but they are the different signature. I mean, we could put a minus. But with our signature, we just have n equal to plus n is equal to 0. And so generically, what we'll see is that this will be the projector will take, this one takes any component along n to 0 and leaves unchanged any component that are particular on the hypersurface. So vectorially, if I have any, say, vector that is pointing in this direction and I hit it with a projector, the only thing I end up with is that component. And we can use it, or we'll use it, for projecting anything. So we can project vectors, derivatives, tensors. Have you guys seen this before? Or use it in significant homeworks? Or just trying to see where it can go fast or it have to go slowly? You haven't seen it much? No? Okay, so generically, we're going to denote, say, if we have a vector or a tensor, sorry, SABC, and we want to project, and we have a new tensor that is related to this one, but everything has been projected, what we compute is the following. So this is going to be, I'm going to define this. And sometimes when we just put a single symbol like this, what we are denoting is every single possible component that can be projected has been projected. So that means the following, we actually have done something like this. Right, we took this tensor that was a full four-dimensional tensor, and we projected every single component with our projector, and we're denoting it with this symbol to say we did the full projection. If at any given point we only project one piece of it, we'll just do it explicitly, denote it explicitly. Otherwise, whenever we have that symbol, we're saying everything has been projected. So further, this projector tells us something else, that this combination . So if I lower the indices of what we define, we have something that is nothing but the three metric. So this is something that is fully projected, as we can prove very easily by just hitting with that projector. And this gamma, if I now ask what is the gamma 0, 0 of this, what we see is that it's precisely 0. So it precisely annihilates that. And we can check, remember our previous expression. We had, well, we'll see this later. But OK, this will be intrinsic metric to sigma. And the other thing we note is that this gamma AB, is the intrinsic metric, and that's the intrinsic metric satisfies things like gamma AB. Let me just denote it this way. So if we take the trace of this, that's equal to 3. So it gives us the trace of the 3 hypersurface. Gamma AB would be the delta 3 AB. So now, we want to also define the derivative operator associated to the gamma that tells us how to take covariant derivatives on the three hypersurface. Again, let me keep stressing, what we're trying to do is end up redefining all the equations where the only covariant derivatives and tensors that we deal with are purely spatial. So now we find it. So the spatial covariant derivative, we're going to denote it with a capital D, A, will be the fully projected result of the covariant derivative we have in the full four-dimensional spacetime. So the simplest case, okay, is the action of this derivative with respect to a scalar. So as an example, dA acting on a scalar phi is just of phi. And if we have, say, for a vector, so you take the derivative, the covariant derivative, as you have done in the full four-dimensional, from the full four-dimensional point of view, and then you project the result. And this one could prove, let's prove this, the dA of gamma BC is exactly equal to zero. So we have a covariant derivative acting on the three space hypersurface, and if we can show that this is equal to zero, we know that's a unique derivative that is intrinsic or is related to the intrinsic metric gamma EB. So this, what we're trying to do is now taking the covariant derivative of the gamma BC, and we want to now use the definitions that we just introduced to find out that this is indeed the case. So let's use a definition. So we have to fully project the derivative with respect to the full four-dimensional spacetime, and then project the result at the end of the day. And so I'm going to, as I said, whenever we're projecting everything, we're just going to keep using that symbol to denote that everything is affected by the projection. So that is, this is by definition gamma A. And now I'm going to rewrite what this gamma BC was, which is GBC, right? So now what we have here is a standard covariant derivative which will obey the standard rule. So the covariant derivative of the sum of two tensors is the sum of the covariant derivative acting on each tensor. So I have this. So what's the result of this thing? That's zero, because by definition, that's the covariant derivative. And the result of this thing is actually, again, this is where the power of the projector comes in. Again, we use Leibniz rule. And this either gives us grad A of NB with NC standing out, or vice versa, right? This is just grad A of this product. But we're projecting everything. And the projector acting on one of the normal vectors gives us a zero. So this is zero. So the next result we would like to show, and again, this we're going to start to skip some of the intermediate steps, is that if we take the covariant derivative of n, and we anti-symmetrize it, we get a zero. Sorry, we project it, and we anti-symmetrize it, we get a zero. That is, grad of a of nb is now, after the projection, is a fully symmetric tensor. And so let me just compute, for instance, so I just see an example of this computation. Again, this is just like we just did. So we want to do the projection of gamma, grad a of nb. So let me just write it all out. So this would be g ca plus nc na gdb. So we now have to do that computation. So let's expand things out. So we know that the g, when the index up and when the index down, is the same thing as the delta. I'm just going to replace it here. And so when we act this one times that one, multiplying this, it's just grad a and b. And then we have a bunch of correcting terms because we're projecting. So the first one is NA and C, grad C and B. Okay, so there we have four terms where we, in the intermediate, in the first, the second and third term, I use the delta to get the nd here and na already there. So now we need to know what this result is. So some things are very easy to say they're zero. So this term is zero because n is a unit vector, and I have nd grad of nd. So I can always put it in, and by iteration by parts, I know this is zero. Similarly here, I can pull the nd in there, and so this will be just the same, just twice grad a of nd, nd say, but that one is zero because of the same reason as that one. So we just have this term on that term. And here I have nc grad c of nb, that's the same thing as a sub b as we define it. So that's what we have. And then, okay, this is, say, page 4 of the notes. The next, there are a few other simply steps like this. And what we end up being able to show is that if we define KAB, which is the same thing we defined before as extrinsic curvature, as minus the full projection of grad A and B, which this result would have immediately told us that it then is completely symmetric, then this is a symmetric tensor, and we can rewrite grad A and B in general as KAB minus KAB minus NA AB, so which also tells us two things. So the first one is that, okay, we know that this is a tensor with a 0,2 component, so grad A of NB, which we have decomposed in two pieces. This one is purely spatial, and this is pointing in the n direction. So this is, if you want, if we had a way to draw what grad A and B is, that the piece that is purely spatial is the KAB, and the piece that points in the normal direction is this one. This result will come in handy later on. So Let me just note one more thing. And this ties with the, one of the last things, actually with precisely what I'm erasing here, but now from a more geometrical, formal way. So now the following. Have you seen, you have seen Lie derivatives, right? Yep, okay, so suppose we compute the Lie derivative along the vector n of, let me just say first, gamma AB. Right, this by definition is in C, grad C, gamma AB, plus right, so here this is just the definition of the Lie derivative acting on gamma. Now let's recall what gamma is. Now we can begin to throw away things. So when grad acts on G, we get a zero. The next piece is NC grad C of this. So let me just, this one survives. Now I have, let me forget about this one for a second. I have NC grad B of grad A and C. That's also equal to zero because I see NC. And in C, we use the fact that it's a uninormal, so this guy doesn't contribute. And the same thing happens here. And then this one just lowers the indices. So grad C will bring the C down and make it a B. Right? OK, but now, we can use our definition, what we just found here. Grad A and B is equal to that, to replace every time we see this here. And notice that, in particular, this has NC grad C of NA and NB. When we split this out, this will be NC grad C of NA times NB plus the same exchanging A to B. But what I have here in the in this parenthesis is what we define as the acceleration with the subindex A times NB. And so here would be AB NA. So we can show, I mean, after using that expression, is that this one is equal to minus 2KAB. And as an exercise also, if we were, if had computed this, it would have been the same. With the projection. So we project the Lie derivative of the full metric, we get the Lie derivative of the three metric. So this is now allows us to reinterpret also the KAB as being nothing more than, well, minus 1/2, the rate of change as dictated by, as calculated by the Lie derivative along the flow of the vector n. So it, again, now it ties this vector n that was defined in a geometrical term with how the hypersurface is going to change as we move along the n. So let me just kind of anticipate what we're going to do tomorrow. Have you guys seen the Gauss-Kodaty expressions? You have?
Yes.
Okay, then I can jump over them, right? Or not? Eh? What do you guys feel? So, can I jump over it or not? Sure. Kind of quiet. I mean, I don't mind either way.
I review what you did.
Okay, I'll review the Nicholas Kodashi. And okay, in which context did you guys see it? What?
We did something of some manifolds within manifolds. So we did it for the Israeli equation.
Oh, okay. So this basically it's a way. So we'll discuss this tomorrow. But it's a way to relate gravity or manifolds in d dimensions to things in d minus one dimensions. So we are going to end up relating curvature pieces here with curvatures plus extrinsic curvature pieces in here, because we said there is no way a deep minus one dimensional manifold will capture everything as far as deep manifold, because the d minus one manifold in its own doesn't know how it is embedded in the larger dimension. But if you add this to the curvature that we compute intrinsically here, to combinations of the extrinsic curvature, then we can encode all the information that was here in this way. And our goal is to now say that everything that we compute here can be computed in terms of gamma ijs and kijs. And this will let us reinterpret or just see everything we've been discussing so far, that we can now see the spacetime as a way, as a sequence of evolution of how these hypersurfaces will change with time. So Einstein's equations will end up given as equations for gamma and equations for k, and this will kind of tell us, we just argued before that k measures kind of the velocity of change of gamma, and we're going to see that Einstein's equations provide an equation that tells us how this changes with time, which will then can be viewed as an acceleration. So it will be how rapidly, from an acceleration point of view, gamma is changing as we move up due to whatever sources of curvature we might have in the spacetime. This is what we'll discuss tomorrow. Okay, let's stop here.